K-Mud Podcast presents.
And now it is time for Heart of the Earth. This is a program about Native Americans and other indigenous cultures. My name is Agnes. What would have been an incredible woman, but she didn't get the chance, is Emily Pike. And maybe you've heard that name in the last couple of weeks. It's getting a lot of national attention. And when I read the story and I heard the story, I mean, I was in tears because it's about, you know, we talk about the missing and murdered indigenous women. And she was 14 years old from the Apache Nation. And after she went missing, they found parts of her body along Highway 60 in Arizona. And that made my hair stand up because I traveled the Southwest last fall, or it was in November. And I avoid the highways. I like the back roads. And we took this, you know, back road. And, we were taking back roads, and we ended up in some strange little town called Globe. And then I said, okay, let's take this Highway 60. It goes through Apache land. So I took that road. It was so beautiful. And it just made my hair stand up when I read the story. So I'm going to share some with you about her. This is Woman's Her Story Month, and I had a whole different show planned, but I thought I had to share about Emily. And this is by Shandine Silversmith of the Arizona Mirror. Say her name, Emily Pike, was shouted repeatedly as hundreds of people gathered outside a church in Mesa, for a vigil to honor and support the family of San Carlos Apache teen Emily Pike, who was murdered in February. We have to say her name, Gail Petulli said. Petulli, the family spokesperson, said it was important because the family wants people to share Emily's story. She said seeing the large crowd showed up in support of Emily has touched her heart. And let me tell you, I've seen the pictures, and there were hundreds and hundreds of people there. Quote, it gives them a lot of hope at a time where they need comfort and strength, she said, and the family understands Emily is now part of the MMIW. The family has been inundated with support and requests to use Emily's story to raise awareness for the missing and murdered indigenous women, the crisis of missing and murdered indigenous women that the family, like so many others, now find itself an unwilling part of. Signs reading, Justice for Emily Pike and No More Stolen Sisters, stood out among the hundreds of indigenous and non-indigenous people gathered on March 6 at Encounter Arizona Church in Mesa for a candlelit vigil for Emily. The family and supporters sat inside the sanctuary. At the same time, hundreds gathered outside as speakers shared their condolences, sang songs in honor of Emily, and discussed the beauty of the community coming together to raise awareness about the ongoing MMIW crisis. Quote, in the midst of tragedy and sorrow, something good should come out of this, Petulli said. That's what gives the family hope. Emily was a member of the San Carlos Apache tribe, and her family lives on the San Carlos Apache Indian Reservation in southeastern Arizona. At the time of her disappearance, the 14-year-old was living in a group home in Mesa. She was last seen on the evening of January 27th near Mesa Drive and McKellips Road, according to the Mesa Police Department. 2 days later, the police issued a poster for Emily, listing her as a missing or runaway juvenile. A month after her missing, the Gila County Sheriff's Office reported that Emily's remains were found on February 14th outside of Globe in a remote area off of U.S. Route 60. A memo from the Sheriff's Office that was leaked on social media reported that there was visible face and head trauma, but the cause of Emily's death was undetermined. It remains an active homicide investigation, and the GCSO is collaborating with several agencies, including the San Carlos Apache Tribal Police Department, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Emily's tragic death has put a spotlight on the harsh realities of missing and murdered Indigenous peoples epidemic that has impacted Indigenous communities for generations, that has only recently drawn attention outside of Native communities. Quote, Indigenous children are disproportionately overrepresented in the child welfare system, not only in Arizona, but in the United States generally, according to the 2024 Interim Progress Report by Arizona's Missing and Murdered Indigenous People Task Force. Indigenous children make up nearly 11% of the children placed in out of home care as of June 30th, 2024, according to statistics from the Arizona Department of Child Safety semi-annual child welfare report from September of 2024. Children placed in group homes are more likely to run away than if they were placed in foster homes or kinship placement, according to the welfare report. The Arizona Missing and Murdered Indigenous Peoples Task Force highlights that the DCS report does not include tribal nations in its data breakdown, making it impossible to quantify the impact on Indigenous communities. Quote, this is a glaring gap because tribes are not notified and they are likely in locations where a tribal child might be found and potential partners to help recover missing and runaway children, reducing the likelihood of exploitation or trafficking, the task report states. When Emily went missing, Petulli said it took a week before the family was notified by the San Carlos Tribal Social Services. Quote, she was labeled as a runaway, Petulli said. The family believes that that is why the group home, the home supervisor, and tribal services did not act right away. Quote, they said that she was going to come back, she said. Quote, she has no place to go. She's 100 miles away from home. She's gonna come back, and the family wasn't notified until a week later. Emily's family did not know what happened or that nothing was being organized to find her. Then a few weeks later, they were told that her body had been found. Quote, they identified her through dental records, but they came to the house to get DNA from the mother, Petulli said. Now the family is waiting for the coroner to release the young girl's body so they can begin the burial services. Quote, the family's priority is to get the remains back and have Emily come home one more time, she said. The family plans to lay her to rest in a burial place near their home in San Carlos. Petulli said that a lot of the major news coverage surrounding Emily's death has focused on her death, how she was a runaway and lived in a group home. Very little has been written about who Emily was. Quote, she was more than that, she said. She had a lot of hope in her. Emily's mother, Stephanie Dosea, said her daughter loved cats and she would always have a cat around their home in San Carlos. Quote, she was a happy girl, her mother said. She liked to brighten everyone's day. She said it had been very emotional to see so many people gathered to support Emily, and it's hard for her to take it all in. Quote, it took a lot of strength to come here, she said of the vigil hosted in honor of her daughter. Doseo said she is thankful for everyone who has shown their support for her daughter and the support for all missing and murdered Indigenous people. Quote, I want justice for my daughter, she added, expressing hope that with so many people raising awareness, it will bring her daughter's case and others. It will help. Yes. What happened to Emily has resonated with many people across Indian country and has put out calls of action to raise awareness around the ongoing missing and murdered Indigenous women's crisis. Shiloh Ashley from the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe attended the vigil and held a sign along the roadside that read, "No More Stolen Sisters." Ashley said she attended the vigil to support the family and raise awareness for the MMIW, but Emily's story also resonated with her since she experienced foster care as a teenager. Quote, it's so heartbreaking, Ashley said. Emily was so young, and what happened to her highlights the vulnerability Indigenous people face. Quote, it's really scary, she added. My heart hurts for her and her family and all the other people that go through this in Indigenous communities. The San Carlos Apache tribe said in a statement that their community is mourning Emily's death. Quote, this is a terrible loss for the teenager's family and our tribe, they stated. Petrulli said that the tribe has never experienced this type of loss before, and it has left many tribal members in shock after all the details came out. Quote, it hurts a lot of people on a lot of levels because she was part of our tribe, she said. And the Apache tribe is going to have a celebration of life for her. I believe it's on March 16th. And what wasn't mentioned in this article was that Emily's body was not found complete. There's parts of her body that are missing. So they only found part of him, and they're still looking for the rest of her. This story has just, it did send shockwaves all across Indian country. Many, many nations held vigils for her all across Turtle Island.
KMUD is a community radio station in the Redwood region of Northern California. Donate to support people-powered radio at kmud.org.
I'm going to share this with you now, and this is from Bela Laskimi, I believe is how you pronounce your name, Nafram, and she's from the Manipura Nation, and she's the founder of the Manipura Women's Gun Survivors Network and the Global Alliance of Indigenous Peoples, Gender, Justice, and Peace. And I really want to thank the American Indian magazine that comes out of Smithsonian, the National Museum of the American Indian. This is their winter edition. And it's entitled Looking to Indigenous Pathways to Peace. And she says, about 476 million Indigenous people are living in 90 countries and territories in the world today. They represent 5,000 different cultures and speak the overwhelming majority of the estimated 7,000 human languages. Indigenous people also manage more than 50% of the world's land, many areas of which are highly biodiverse. Unfortunately, more than 100 armed conflicts are ongoing across our planet today, many of which are in the areas where Indigenous people live, displacing 117 million people and devastating their life ways, as well as the land they and wildlife depend upon for survival. She says, I grew up in Manipur, a beautiful border state in northeast India that is home to 3.3 million Indigenous peoples. It has been under the shadow of internal conflicts for more than 70 years. I was determined to find peace for our communities, so as a Manipura scholar, I found the Manipur Women's Gun Survivors Network in Imphal in 2007 and the Global Alliance of Indigenous Peoples, Gender, Justice, and Peace in New York in 2019. My colleagues and I asked ourselves, quote, what ROM have we as humans done that instead of progressing, we are regressing as a global community? We have thought hard and long about what are the root causes of such violence and what could be the solutions. Indigenous peoples have lived for centuries with violence in their lives, yet the resilience that they have shown in the face of conflicts gives us the hope that we may find paths to peace building. To heal people and the planet, we need to investigate what is happening in Indigenous territories and look to traditional methods of conflict mitigation in order to work towards a world in which peace is the norm rather than an aberration. Indigenous peoples have unique ways of peace building that they have employed for centuries. For example, the Hanandasi, who live in what is now the border region of the northeastern United States and Canada, have, quote, the Great Law of Peace, a guide to living among themselves and other nations that preferences reason over force. They and other Indigenous peoples of this region wrote their laws and treaties not on paper, but on different materials, such as wampum belts. These agreements, which are recorded in the belt's designs that are made with shell beads sewn together, have been passed down for generations. Other Indigenous forms of governance and constitutions evolved during the 12th century in North America, Asia, and many other countries. Indigenous manuscripts from the India state of Manipur, called Puyas, were written on Tegna, a local grass, palm leaves, agar wood, bamboo pulp, or jute, and even inscribed on copper plates. These documents were written collaboratively and have been passed down for generations as a shared living knowledge. One of these manuscripts is the translates to Dialects of the Forest, which outlines how humans can coexist with nature. Indigenous women across cultures and nations have developed peaceful mechanisms to confront decades of militarization, weaponization, and structural violence that have marked their lives for decades. For example, in 1904 and 1939, Indigenous women in Manipur waged two nonviolent demonstrations known as Nupilan Women's War against repressive British colonial policies. Their negotiations sowed the seeds of Manipur achieving freedom from British colonial rule in 1947. In spite of such successes, peacemaking efforts for the past century have been usually negotiated at high political levels where Indigenous peoples are rarely represented. For example, Indigenous peoples have been trying to engage with the League of Nations since the 1920s and with the United Nations since the 1970s to resolve, mitigate, and prevent violent conflicts. The 1982 Manila Declaration on the Peaceful Settlement of International Disputes drew attention to the need of peaceful resolution of international conflicts, yet did not include a discussion of the needs of Indigenous populations. The first time that the United Nations involved Indigenous peoples in peacemaking was in 1996, when the UN moderated peace talks between the Guatemalan government and the Guatemalan National Revolutionary Unity. The resulting, quote, agreement on a firm and lasting peace ended decades of conflicts in Guatemala, during which 200,000 people were killed, 83% of whom were indigenous Maya residents. In 2000, Indigenous peoples called for the creation of new systems and institutions of peacemaking that are sourced in Indigenous values and that coexist with the policies of existing bodies such as the International Court of Justice. 7 years later, the UN adopted the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which contains several articles that are very relevant to preventing conflict, such as the rights of Indigenous communities to self-determination, to their lands, territories, and resources, to prevention of genocide of their people, and to prevention of forced transfers of their populations. It also ensured that the independent Indigenous peoples' own tribunals and commissions of inquiry are recognized as legitimate in any process of conflict resolution. The UN pledged in 2015 to strengthen universal peace in part by reducing poverty by 2030. When I reread this last night, I mean, I just laughed when I read that because so much of the people providing food for them was through USAID, which 47 just discontinued. He's been forced to pay the ones that were our work was already done for. But now I don't know if that'll happen now. Yet, conflict in Indigenous lands and territories have not decreased, but rather increased. Today, Indigenous communities are in areas with contested borders and are on the front lines of violent conflict, insurgency, and organized crime, with devastating humanitarian impacts and loss of life. The challenges of obtaining peace in conflict zones were excluded from the original mandate of the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues of 2007, and the UN Permanent Forum and Indigenous Issues took 46 years to designate conflict, peace, and resolution as the special theme for its 15th session in May of 2016. In 2021, the UN's Human Rights Council resolved to prepare a report on the militarization of Indigenous land to address the issue, but this has yet to be completed and released to the public. You know, and I've always said, they go in with the military into the Indigenous lands and they take out all the resources. That's what it's all about. Well, on April 11th and 12th of 2024, 120 indigenous peoples from 30 countries and territories gathered in Washington, D.C. to attend the first global summit on indigenous peacebuilding. They came to share the wisdom of their ancestors so that attendees and future generations can help heal people and the planet. The event led to the adoption and signing of the first International Declaration on Indigenous Peacebuilding, which says decision makers must acknowledge and include Indigenous peacemaking practices and calls for a zero tolerance for violence on Indigenous lands. This was the first time that Indigenous peoples from around the world were able to gather to write such a document themselves rather than having doctrine written for them. In addition, attendees formed a global network on indigenous peacemakers, peace builders, meditators, and negotiators. This will help connect indigenous leaders in peacemaking efforts from elders to youth. This historic summit also led to the inclusion of indigenous peacebuilding in the outcome document of the 23rd UN Permanent Session of Indigenous Issues held in April of 2024, as well as a resolution the UN passed on the 17th of November of 2024 at its General Assembly that calls upon UN member states to emphasize, quote, the importance of meaningful engaging indigenous peoples in peace agreement negotiations, transitional justice processes, conflict resolution, meditation, and constructive arrangements. We have seen the indigenous peoples have a variety of traditions, cultures, and religious practices to resolve violence and build peace. And while often highly successful, these methods are underappreciated by the peace-building community or ignored entirely in formal peace processes. Yet the protection of peace, people, and planet cannot be complete if indigenous peoples are left behind. Any efforts to end global conflicts must include indigenous peoples at every level of decision-making. Indigenous knowledge, science, economies, governance, constitutions, and diplomacy are all pathways toward healing conflict zones around the world. And again, this was from Bina Lakshmi Nepram from the Manipur Nation in India. And I felt it was important to share this with you, because we're never going to have peace on earth without peace with earth. We must make peace with earth. And when you rape the indigenous women, you are raping Mother Earth. The two are very connected. Unless you watch MSNBC or Democracy Now, listen to that, you may not be knowing about all the people, the hundreds and hundreds of people in small cities and big cities alike that have been protesting at their government offices, at their so-called representative offices. And then you hear, oh, well, Democrats aren't really doing anything. Well, that's because it's not being reported on. A handful of Democratic representatives have been calling, you know, meetings, having town, you know, town councils, town meetings, and doing it just a couple of blocks away from the border of the next district that's Republican. And so all those people are coming to them and listening. And I hear people say, yeah, well, you know, the media isn't covering a lot of this. It doesn't take the energy away from what you're doing. Whether it gets reported or not, it's nice when it is. But we, the people, have the power. This is Women's History Month. Honor all the women, but especially Mother Earth.
This has been a K-Mud podcast. To listen to other shows and more episodes of this show, find us on all the platforms where you get your podcast, and also on our website, kmud.org.